Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 265. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to keep the intro brief this week so we can get straight into that good, tasty chat. Thanks for all the love that came in for the Nish Kumar episode last week. This week's guest is Ed Gamble, who we talked about in the Nish episode. And in this episode, we talk about Nish. So that's some crossover stuff going on there. Things I need to tell you about in the intro, as I said, I'm going to try and keep this brief. Ed is doing two specials, or two performances of his special, two filmings of his special, on May 12th at the Leicester Square Theatre. So get down there. It's great. If you're not already listening to Off Menu, you need to get on with that. It's going to be great. It is great. But what's going to be great is something that we announce in this episode that involves myself, Ed Gamble, and James Acaster. I think you're going to get quite excited about it. I hope to see you barrage all three of us with social media torrents of excitement. Oh, I want to talk about it now, but that'll ruin it. We're going to talk about it in the episode. It's fine. There's some exciting crossover potential ahead. So I won't say any more than that. On patreon.com/scroobiouspip, it's Poem of the Month time coming up on Monday, which is where you get a free spoken word piece from me. And then a couple of weeks after that, it will be the Distraction Pieces Rewind, which has been going down a treat, which is a bonus podcast every third Monday of the month. And it's where I give some kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. In fact, I've been given a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that I maybe shouldn't be given, but it's behind a pay, it's hidden on Patreon. I mean it's a paywall that's only $1 a month high, but still, I don't think I'm going to get in trouble if you all keep it a secret. But yeah, that's all over there. speechdevelopmentrecords.com, as ever, you know that. If you like the podcast and want to support by buying a Distraction Pieces mug, a Distraction Pieces t-shirt, all sorts of Scroobius Pip stuff, there's my live Edinburgh Fringe show, then head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. But I don't need to say much more than that. If you enjoyed this episode, you might want to go all the way back in the archives and listen to my episode with James Acaster, which was at least 3 years ago. It was before he kind of became the comedy behemoth that he has become. So it's a pretty cool little early insight. In fact, a lot of comedians that we talk about and praise on this podcast, I've had on the podcast in the past. So if you want to check any of those previous guests, it's a hell of a back catalogue. It goes back over 5 years, so I have a good old browse. But other than that, I'll see you at the end. I'll give you a little bit of information about Pod Bible and other things. Essentially, Pod Bible is where you go and hear about new podcasts, so I've told you that now. But anyway, this is episode 265 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Mr. Ed Gamble. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. It's going to be a lovely little chat. I'm looking forward to this.
So am I.
Well, we shall begin.
Nice.
I'm joined today by Ed Gamble. How are you, sir?
All right, mate. Thank you. Very well. How are you?
I'm good. And this is nice because I've been on your podcast and now I get to have you on mine.
You were the debut guest on
podcast.
Yeah.
And how's it all been since then? Because it's blown up. And it's
been great, yeah.
Not to kiss your ass. It's on my... There's a long list of podcasts I listen to, but Off Menu is on the short list of podcasts that I never miss an episode.
Oh, that's very nice.
Because I just love the format. Again, what I was discussing it with the guys at Acast earlier is because of the format and because of the way you and James are with it, even if it's someone I've not heard of, you just want to hear about food and stuff and what they're eating.
You tend to learn a lot about people, right? Through the food choices. But yeah, I think we were really happy with the format. But I think initially I tend to overthink things. So when we first came up with it, I think my first thought was, it's very simple. It's very simple format, just asking people their dream meal and dream sort of starter, main, dessert, side and drink. But then that's all you need really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's the perfect balance because if you'd gone any more complex,
you'd potentially struggle at times for guests.
Yes.
Because guests are all right with doing a little bit of prep.
A tiny bit of prep.
But they don't want a fucking
no.
week's homework
exactly.
to be coming in with, here is my dissertation yeah. on my yeah. main meal.
And most people, I think, I find like most people who are busy or doing things within the media will just think about things in the car on the way there anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people will normally turn up and go, okay, what was this again?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, but they, most people have got that stuff about food logged.
That's the beauty
ready
of it.
To go. Yeah.
You've got your most natural go-tos. Brett Goldstein's Films to be Buried with podcast, yeah. I adore. But also I think, I guarantee there's some guests who are like, I need a bit more time to think about that.
Because there's like a bit of prep. Yeah.
With films, for some reason, there's that connection and real,
yeah, exactly.
I don't want to commit to anything. I did his ages ago, and I've already changed about 5 of my ideas.
Yeah, same.
In fact, from listening to yours,
oh really?
There's been several things I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I should have gone for that for a side, or should have gone for this and that. Yeah.
Oh no, I love that podcast so much. But you're right, the categories people you really need to think about.
Yeah,
it. I did
man.
Blood on the Tracks recently as well.
Oh,
and that's
I love
one where
that podcast. How was that?
It was really fun.
Yeah.
But I spent ages thinking about that, and I feel like, you know, when you arrive at something, you know you've put in the most prep out of everyone.
Yeah. And Colin is such a piece of shit with it, because he makes it competitive.
Yeah, yeah,
he
absolutely.
He makes it, like, it would be easy to go, you know, it's all a bit of fun. He's like, no, there is going to be a winner.
Yeah.
And there are going to be 3 losers.
Yeah.
This is real.
And my music taste is so against everything else that any other guest on those sorts of things would normally pick, I think.
Yeah.
But I tried to go mainstream for what I like, and people were still like, this is very loud. Ed.
This is what's going on. What is your music taste? Let's go... go into that again. I like doing, obviously you've got your special to promote, but in general I try and get people when there's not too much that they have to push or promote.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I mean,
I'm never
anything and everything.
Yeah, I'm never really pushing anything.
Yeah.
I think
let's talk about music for a bit. Well, because again, I've got hints of it from Off Menu.
Yeah,
and I grew up into punk and hardcore.
Sure.
And again, on Off Menu, James will often mention that you've got dark, scary tattoos, and you listen to angry music, and it's always me going, well, that sounds familiar. Let's hear more on it.
Yeah.
So, what kind of stuff are you?
Well, I'd say broadly metal, but yeah. sort of. I said this to Colin Murray that my taste is quite broad, but
yeah.
then I say metal, and then I like punk and hard rock as well.
Yeah.
But that's not broad, is it?
No, exactly.
But all from within that world, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. I went to see. It's going to catch you off guard, potentially.
Go on.
But I went to see wrestler Chris Jericho, his band Fozzy.
Okay, yeah, yeah,
because he's got like a hair metal type band.
Sure.
And I'd had him on the podcast, and I'm a fan of wrestling. And I went to the gig like, this is going to be so awkward and cringy. 10 minutes in, as soon as you let go of it,
yeah.
it was one of the most fun gigs I've ever been to. Because that area
fun,
of metal
yeah.
isn't an area I've ever been particularly into.
Yeah,
that kind
yeah.
of really over the top,
yeah.
like really screaming. And yeah, 10 minutes in, I was like, this is one of the best gigs I've ever been to. Because
yeah.
everyone in the crowd isn't trying to be cool. No one is trying
no.
to think about anyone. They're just enjoying
that sort of music has not
moment.
Been cool since the 80s. So.
No. Darkness had a go.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than
but they
that,
embraced the ridiculousness of
yeah,
it as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
yeah.
And that was exactly it. I
yeah,
love
that's
that.
That's it's a really smooth transition from wrestling to that sort of music, I think, because
yeah.
it's so performative and
it's
so
such
over
a
the
performance.
Top. Yeah. He's great. I emceed the Metal Hammer Golden God Awards a couple
oh,
of
wow.
years ago,
yeah,
and
he was
hosting.
Yeah.
So I had to intro him to the stage, and Clutch and Mastodon were playing,
wow.
who were two of my favourite bands
yeah.
of all time, so that was really exciting.
He's such a good dude, and he knows his... It's so weird, because it felt like for ages, Fozzy were looked down upon, because it was a wrestler doing a band.
Sure,
and then
yeah.
all of a sudden, they were embraced by every other band, and everyone
yeah,
seemed,
yeah.
They seem to be everyone's favourite, because again, on paper it seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
You get to it, you're like, oh, this is wonderful.
Also,
what a lovely
I think,
man.
I think they earned a bit of cred, because it's clearly... he wants to do it and that's what he's committed to doing
yeah.
rather than you see so many actors or like wrestlers or anything
yeah.
or comedians going, I'm going to have a band for a bit and then they'll like tour it once and do one album. But he's
yeah.
like, he's 100% down
he'll
to
be
do
at
it
the top of his wrestling game and he'll take a year off
yeah,
to
yeah,
tour.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's like, you're literally headlining WrestleMania. He's like, no,
yeah.
no, I've got a tour book. So I'm
yeah,
gonna be,
yeah.
we've got a new album out. We're going to be focusing on that next year. So
it's great.
I love that shit. Did you go to gigs a lot as a kid?
Yeah, I went to quite a lot of gigs as a kid when I was allowed.
Were you London?
Yeah, London-based. Yeah, so it was great. So, you know, there was loads of gigs that I could play.
What kind of stuff did you catch? Have you got any standouts or first?
First gig was Korn at Wembley Arena.
Amazing.
Which was incredible.
Yeah.
That was a really exciting one.
Were you drawn into the new metal kind of?
Yeah, because that's the sort of... So I was about 13
Korn
or 14.
Because Korn were just kind of outside of that. But yeah, I was massively...
Yeah.
Limp Bizkit, Papa Roach,
totally.
All of that, that...
Papa Roach, weirdly, was
a
sort of
a
yeah,
now,
second generation new metal, so I'd sort 100%. Of strayed away from it then. So Korn, obviously, is like first.
Yeah.
But then I started getting into it in 98, 99,
yeah.
when it all really kicked off. So Slipknot, System of a Down,
yeah.
were the two, Deftones as well,
yeah.
were the sort of main bands that I was yeah. really, really into. And Korn at Wembley Arena was an amazing gig. And I went to like a Slipknot signing. On Virgin Megastore on Oxford Street.
When I was 18, I briefly tried to live in America on my own, which was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I'd saved some money to go travelling with a mate. Turns out he hadn't saved any. And I kind of went, well, I've saved it,
yeah.
so I can either not go or go. And I went and didn't think about the fact that you need to be 21 to go anywhere interesting in
yeah.
America. So 18 on my own. But one of the things I did do was go and see Slipknot. In America,
yeah,
and it was the first time I saw the proper kind of American slam dancing,
yeah,
because I'd been in tons of mosh pits in the
yeah.
UK, but in over there when they do the full arm swinging and doing
terrifying.
Spin kicks,
it's terrifying
stuff like that, and I was literally just there on my own, just like. What's going on? I'd mainly gone because Head PE was supporting. And
right,
I really liked
That's
Head
incredible.
PE at the time. So, but I stuck around for Slipknot as well. And yeah.
I think, I guess Head PE weren't supporting Korn at Wembley Arena. It was POD. So
POD,
I'm getting mixed up with my
was.
acronym
see, POD,
metal bands.
Weirdly, were really religious.
Yeah, they were Christian, right?
Payable
on death. Yeah.
yeah, POD was a weird one. But again, it was the era. Which I hope has passed, but it was an era I was surrounded by in my local area. But it was the era when white people with dreadlocks was very much an acceptable thing.
Oh, especially in the world of new metal, right?
Yeah, it was
yeah.
massive. It was really... I think it's why Head PE jumped out to me, because like,
yeah.
oh, they've got an actual black person in there.
Right,
so
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
this doesn't feel weird anymore. It's not someone just... Yeah. But that was madness. I had Wes Borland on the podcast, and Wes has become a mate over the years. And it was mad
yeah.
talking to him, because he went through the same thing as all Limp Bizkit fans. He
yeah.
went through a period of going, this is so shit. And this is so rubbish. And then he's kind of come back round again and accepted it, which is similar. I've had some Limp Bizkit songs come on in recent years
yeah.
and gone, break stuff's a tune. I know it's not
mate,
cool.
It's
but-
a complete tune. Like, I think I like Limp Bizkit more now than I did
yeah.
back in the day, because I think I got so seriously into it, and they were still a bit sort of, they were like frowned upon within
they were
the
such
yeah,
a pop version
serious
of
rock
yeah.
world. But now
around Rolling time, around Rolling yeah. when they became too big, it was like, no, this is frat boy shit. It was alternative music that had transcended the alternative. It
yeah.
was now the frat boy stuff, and you're like, well,
because that
that's
first
not ours.
That first album,
yeah.
they were on, because I had this VHS of the Family Values tour,
yes.
which was them, Korn, Rammstein, and
yes.
Orgy.
Yes,
and they were kind of, that was their first album, and they were people were excited about them. And then they did that George Michael
they had
cover.
The cover of Faith.
Yeah,
yeah, that was brilliant.
And then second album got a bit bigger, and then the third album was huge, and that's when everyone else sort of turned off them a little bit, and
yeah.
they became like a huge like frat boy thing.
A significant other. That was the second one, I think.
Yeah,
and that was
yeah,
my
yeah.
era of Limp Bizkit. I was
yeah.
like, this is great, it's big, but it's...
Yeah, it's a good album.
Kind of, at that point, because we didn't really have that much going on the internet, it had to be reasonably big for us to have it in the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's one of them. It's like, it can't be that underground, or
yeah.
I can't hear it.
Yeah, exactly.
I can
yeah.
read about it, but can't listen to it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was the kind of... the perfect Limp Bizkit era. I'm trying to think of who else that time. I always remember I got put off System of a Down... because of how big they got and how
right,
odd
okay.
they got. And the only reason was, I was at my local alternative club, which I only went to a few times. It was called the Fat Surfer. And there was bands and there was music in between. And they were playing some music and they played a System of a Down song. And then they went on to like a Green Day song or something.
Yeah.
And I love Green Day, stuff like that. And the crowd all linked arms and jumped up and down chanting System until they played another System of a Down song, and at that point I went, fuck this lot, this is
they're ruining
Green Day and Offspring for me, and that's the real music.
Yeah, that's the proper underground shit, right? They're not playing all the underground stuff like Green Day and Offspring.
But again, I think there's such an overlooked thing in that area of music, and particularly when you look back, is bands like Green Day and Offspring, for example, and Limp Bizkit. They're the ones that were gateways to then get into Lagwagon and Screeching Weasels and just all sorts of more obscure punk bands. And it's like, at that age, you're so predetermined to kind of go, oh, they're big now, I'm not into them, they're sold out. Whereas when you look back, I said, you can kind of give that respect to, well, I wasn't ready for those other bands. I needed Limp Bizkit or whatever. Incubus was one that I always felt never got the praise that they deserved for their early stuff. Their early albums I absolutely thought were a work of art, and then they got very poppy.
Incubus are one of those bands that I was sort of naturally against when I, because I was like a proper little like mangy grunger.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh no, he's too pretty, he takes his top off.
So pretty.
Yeah. So I didn't like them because he was all pretty.
Well, that was it. It was the point that he did, they had that, was it Are You In or Wish You Were Here or something? It was Wish You Were Here, where he took his top off in the video and he had his cool faint red tattoos.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like the coolest shit.
Playing bongos and shit.
And that at that point, I was like, no. I had the first album where they were screaming and they were like 18 and it was the most intense thing ever. And it's a bizarre one. So what was your kind of upbringing like, and when did comedy come into it? Like you say, you were kind of the grungy, metal-y kids.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily open itself up to...
But it kind of... Like, I say I was a grungy, metal-y kid, but that's within, like, quite a... I was at quite a posh school. Yeah, like, not boarding school, but as posh as you can get without it being boarding school, let's say. So it wasn't like we were all separated into different, like, tribes, like some sort of film. Like, we were all pretty posh, and I just happened to like heavy music. Yeah. So, you know, and I was always the bit of a class clown, sounds such a stereotype, I just, I've always pissed about, basically.
Yeah, perfect.
And I was always interested in comedy, I think. And my mum, I always credit my mum with, she took me to see, I guess this is 1999 as well, Steve Coogan's Man Who Thinks He's It live tour. Because we were just walking past the theatre one day in London. That's and I think amazing. I was like aware of Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
And they had the poster up. And I remember just going, we could go and see that. She's like, yeah, come on, we'll go and buy your tickets now. So we just walked into the box office and bought tickets.
Yeah.
And he did,
that's amazing.
Partridge and Paul and Paul Incarnate.
Yeah, I love it. I used to watch the video of that constantly. Was that video the tour amazing. That had Simon Pegg on as well?
And Julia Davis.
Just when he's. I like you. You're a bit punky.
Yeah.
That's it. One of the guys on our tour would do that. Do it just slightly to make us laugh. We'd be at a new venue. We're like, I like her. She's a bit punky. It's just so good.
Because all of that video is amazing because of all of the backstage stuff and all of the interviews with Steve Coogan, the character.
Yeah.
It's so good. And there's a whole running bit, which I always quote when anyone gets a bad review or I get a bad review, I get annoyed about it. He's really annoyed that he's got a bad review. And he's going, the thing is, I don't care. I just need to let it roll off me. And then he pulls out this weapon that he's made. But if I ever meet him, I've designed this fish hook. And it doesn't hurt going in. But when it comes out, pulls a chunk of your cheek out.
Yeah, it's so good. And that was just, I mean, that's an amazing style of comedy to be exposed to at a reasonably a young age, right?
Yeah, so
what's
I was
that going to be, 17? 16,
no,
17,
no,
18?
No. Earlier than that. Earlier than that. 14, maybe.
So 14. That's amazing. Yeah, again, he was doing a lot of characters, and it was at a period when character comedy had gone completely out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't kind of the done thing. It was far more at that point you'd had your revolution in comedy. You had your new comedy and your left-wing comedy and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Alternative comedy. So how was that to go in there and see someone who's putting on so many different... I always felt with that era of Coogan, it felt like it should be kind of shit Butlin's Cabaret.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's brilliant. It felt like you could see someone doing at Butlin's at that weekend, he's doing five characters and one of them's a lounge singer and one of them's in drag. Literally everything he does would all fit there, yet it was fucking brilliant.
Yeah, it was an incredibly well put together show.
Yeah.
And Simon Pegg and Julia Davis doing stuff in that show as well.
Amazing. Yeah,
absolutely amazing. So that sort of, I think that started me being really interested in comedy. I remember, like, the school I went to, they had, the Cambridge Footlights came and toured and did a show in our theatre as well.
Wicked.
So I probably went to that when I was like 16 or 17.
Yeah.
And that blew me away.
Yeah.
And I applied to go to Cambridge the next day because of it.
Wow.
And did not get in. But
I love that there is an area of people who were after going to one of the best, most prestigious schools in the country.
Yeah.
For the comedy.
Totally.
For the Footlights. And they're generally, particularly at that time when you've had your Stephen Fry's and all of these kind of come through that. I love that. It's like the kind of an artistic version of In America where you get a scholarship because of your football.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm in Cambridge, but just for my comedy.
Oh, I would have loved the scholarship if they'd done that, looked into my comedy and I'd got in there because of that. That was the only way I was going to get in there. Certainly not. I applied for philosophy and I didn't know what it was, really.
Brilliant. Well, that's kind of the perfect place to be with philosophy.
Yeah. But what is philosophy? They don't fall for that shit at Cambridge,
imagine
unfortunately.
If you applied that. The real question is, what is philosophy? It's
You're in.
Can you teach? So how did that go? So you didn't get into Cambridge, but you'd had people like the Footlights exposed to you and you'd had Partridge. Yeah. So what kind of...
And I was going to stand-up clubs as well when I was 16 or 17.
Oh,
so
wicked.
I'd go... So I grew up in Wimbledon and there was a stand-up club every Friday. And I'd go like once, twice a month to that.
Do you remember anyone you'd kind of see in that era? I know... Club scene, it's normally
it's difficult, and it was like a laughing horse club, and they're still going, but there's sort of a lot of open spots and a lot of new acts. So I can't really remember. I saw Marek Larwood do a set there. Marek's brilliant. He was stand up for a long time. He's in a sketch group called We Are Clang with Greg Davis and Steve Hall.
Yes.
And he's very like over the top, ridiculous, grotesque stuff. Yeah. And I remember seeing him and absolutely killing myself laughing.
Yeah.
But it was just the feeling of being in there. And I remember I went up to the MC after one of the gigs and went, how do I have a go at this?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And did you start to kind of... Or get involved?
I didn't until I'd gone to uni. So I went to Durham in the end and did comedy there and set up a stand-up night there.
Or was it intimidating to see such a variation of comedy at a young age, or was it inspirational? I always remember, I was 17 or 18 when I went to see Simon Munnery.
Yeah.
And it kind of, for a while, it ruined all other art.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Why would I compromise in any way? Because he was just doing the most amazing, mind-blowing stuff. And he had clearly complete control, complete freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you try and do anything in music, in acting, in anything, you instantly have to compromise
in some
way.
Of course.
But if you've seen someone like that, particularly for a young mind, you'd be like, well, why would I compromise at all? I don't care if only one person sees it.
So I think Munnery was that for me as well, weirdly, because I think all the comedy I really liked growing up and before I did comedy is completely different to the sort of thing that I do now. So Simon Munnery was a big thing for me. Dan Antopolsky as well, who was just incredible. I went to see him like every year in Edinburgh.
I never saw him. He was another one that his name was always on that list of people. It's just get in and see him. And
And proper bizarre stuff. Yeah. And totally in control of his own thing. And it's just his own world. But so different to what I just tell stories and stuff.
But it's that inspiration and that spark, isn't it? So how did things start at Durham? And were you, was it at Durham, were you with a few other comedians around that time?
Yeah, so...
Because I'm sure there's a load of you all kind of came
from the same... There's
a few of
us, And they've got a bit of a history, Durham, but nothing like the Footlights do for Cambridge or the Oxford Review or anything.
Until we turned up
and flipped the whole game on its head. So there is like a sketch group there called the Durham Review that I basically went to see in my first week of Durham and thought, okay, they're all right, but I can do better than this.
Again, that's a kind of... It's one of the beautiful inspirations of rap and punk rock music.
Yeah, totally.
You go to it and love it, but you also go to go, I could do that.
Yeah, I could definitely
do that. And not in a disrespectful way. Yeah. You go to go, this is achievable. The first two gigs I went to were the Rolling Stones at Wembley with a giant snake breathing fire over the audience. And you go to that and go, I couldn't do that.
That's not me,
And the other one, that's the same week, was Offspring at Brixton Academy on the Smash Tour. So before that, gone too cheesy. And you see that and go, no, that I could do that.
I could see myself doing that.
That's a beautiful inspiration, isn't it? Because it's not insulting in any way, but... Man, it's motivating.
I mean, I definitely don't feel that personally about rap music. I don't think I've ever seen a rapper and gone, I think I've got some bars up my sleeve.
Mate, I got 10 years out of it as a white kid from Essex. So I literally, thank you to Beastie Boys and all the other rap bands I saw in those early days, and went, man, I could do that. But yeah, so how was that to Oh, who were you at Durham when you started to make the scene as such?
I did Durham Review for a year with a few other people, and none of whom are doing comedy now, but very talented. But and then the year after that, we got to audition people, the new people coming in. And two of the people we auditioned were Nish Kumar and Tom Neenan.
Yeah, amazing.
Nish is obviously brilliant and doing amazingly well.
As this goes out, last week's guest on the Distraction Pieces podcast, and he sat exactly there.
Nice.
So yeah.
And Tom Neenan is an incredible writer and performer, does these amazing one-man shows, and does a lot of writing for The Mash Report with Nish.
He's
been nominated for a BAFTA for The Mash Report. So.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And rightfully so. It was amazing talking to Nish about it, because I kind of had to admit, it took me a minute to get into The Mash Report, and then when I got it, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And he quite quickly said, oh no, it was shit at the start.
No, but that is...
He was like, it took us a minute to get into it. We didn't know what we were doing. It
typical was... Nish.
Yeah.
Any opportunity to talk himself down.
It's perfect, because I was like, yeah, I didn't really get it at first. Like, we didn't really get it at first. We were feeling it out.
It's a new type of thing, right?
Yeah. That's the beauty of having that moment. I'm reading... I swear I've mentioned it in every podcast I've recorded this week, but I'm reading... a lot of acting stuff at the moment, and I'm reading David Mamet, who's a playwright and director. And one of the things he talks about is you can spend years in acting schools, but that's all just trying to keep you in this system and trying to trade and make money and whatever else. Whereas you'll learn far more going up on stage and doing it and going out and being part of it and learning from the crowd and learning direct, not being told by some dusty old prick that you're good, being told by the reaction of the audience that you're good or that you're shit.
Yeah.
And I loved kind of the story of The Mash Report and a few other things like that, where there is that little bit of, right, we've just got to go out there and figure it out.
Yeah.
We've kind of been thrown this opportunity. We could have gone, oh, no, we're not ready.
Yeah.
We'll come back in a bit. We'll plan. But no, it's better to go, all right, cool, let's do it. Let's jump
in. It's good
in.
They had room to do that,
let's
really.
Let's go there, yeah.
Because it's so rare in telly now that you get any room to be shit for a bit.
Mate, 100%. And I think in performing in general, because of YouTube and stuff like that, I was chatting with a spoken word artist I gigged with loads over the years, Polar Bear, and both of us stopped gigging ages ago, and he's got 3 or 4 books out, which are amazing, and I'm doing all sorts of other bits. And both of us were like, part of the thing that puts us off coming back and doing a gig is we'd have to get good again.
Yeah.
Because we spent years being shit, but no one was watching.
Yeah.
If we come back now, there's going to be an audience there, and they're going to want us to be good. And
yeah, but I think you could. I don't know. I love that bit of it. That's what stand-up is to me. Like making a new
That's
show
kind of
is
the beauty
being
of stand-up, right? Is you get to tour it and try things out, and work in progress type things. Totally.
And
thing.
So you do a new material, and like you do a work in progress thing.
Yeah.
No matter how long you've been going, if you're doing brand new material, a lot of it's going to be like very poor.
Yeah.
And I like being at that stage, and I always panic that I'm never going to get it back, that I'm never going to get a show together. And then I'm at the stage where I'm at now, where I'm touring it, and every night where I do it, I was like, all right, yeah, I can.
Yeah.
It's fine.
How are you as a work in progress guy? Because I remember I went to see two... I love comedy, and I went to see two work in progresses in the same night, and one was Simon Amstel.
Yeah.
And I think he's a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a real work in progress. It was a real, here's some ideas.
Yeah.
I throw things out. All right, well, that kind of works. That doesn't. It's a bizarre one because his whole persona is slightly awkward and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So when you're actually doing new material and are slightly awkward and uncomfortable, it's like, oh, right, this is a weird interaction.
Yeah.
But the other one that night, I was a Ramesh.
Yeah.
And I was like, In what way is this a work in progress? Because that was essentially the most polished stand-up show I've ever seen. And it was like, there is a difference in the way comedians approach
it,
right? I know the American way is very much, or the traditional American way is very much just work the clubs. Work in progress, just throwing ideas out. Here's a topic, go back and forth. But the British way, I think, because of the fringe and stuff like that at times, is a work in progress is, here's the hour I've written.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's refine it and polish it. So where do you sit on the work in progress kind of seesaw?
Well, if I'm building a new show, I will have to do like just entire hours of new material a lot of the time, or go to a new material night and do 10, 15 minutes of new stuff.
Yeah.
Because the American system always seems more sensible to me, that because they're working the clubs and they're headlining clubs, then they need to do, they have their hour, but like 50 minutes of that will be stuff they've been doing for ages and it's super polished. And then they build in new stuff, then get rid of old stuff. So they've constantly got an owl, but it's in flux with new and old stuff. Whereas, quite often if you go to a Edinburgh preview in London, especially like around like April, May, you will see some absolute horseshit.
Yeah.
Because I'm quite apologetic when I do it as well. It's not a pleasant experience. Yeah. It's normally me going, oh God, I knew this would be bad. I'm so sorry, everyone.
And don't let the you know, the size and smell of the small room above a pub, the performances being done in, fool you into thinking that's not exactly what you're getting.
Yeah.
A very rough... It's exactly the right
it's the
location
perfect,
for most the of the most work in progress.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, this is a bit dingy, but, you know, it's James Acaster. It's going to be pretty good. It's like, you wait.
Oh, you wait, no, his are.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, he's fucking ridiculous, that boy.
I was going to talk about that, because James, obviously, a mutual friend. In fact, this is a good point to mention, that we're going to be doing a special podcast, you, me and James.
Oh, I'm excited about this.
And this has come about from me listening to Off Menu and having been on, and James keeps mentioning his love of Ben and Jerry's. Yeah. And there's a few stories where he, on the way home from a party, he ate a whole tub and things like that. And I've been sitting there each time listening, thinking, so where's the weird bit? Like, why is everyone shocked? I've had weekends where between Friday and Sunday lunchtime, I've eaten four or five tubs of Ben and Jerry's just without planning it. It's just happened casually.
I mean, it annoys me so much. You and James are both in like such a good shape as well.
You see, the difference is I've now, I think I'm a few years older than James, so I work out constantly now, because it is to maintain my unhealthy lifestyle. But I text James after one of them saying, I could eat you under the table. That sounds really sexy.
I mean, it really does.
Are you about tonight?
I know this special pub where they let you do that.
No, I was just saying that you talk about ice cream a lot. I reckon I can eat more than you. And he was very cocky.
Yeah.
He was in full character, James.
Yeah.
And then I shook him a little bit because I sent him a photo. I was the first person in the UK to be given a Ben and Jerry's gold card.
Yeah.
So in scoop shops, I just go in and show my card and I get free ice cream.
Oh, man, he'll be so jealous.
My legendary Ben and Jerry's status. And you guys have since been sent a load of stuff from Ben and Jerry's.
That is the highlight of his entire life, I think, being sent that
it's
stuff.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. So what he suggested, I think he suggested it half joking. He said, oh, we should do a drunk cast, but with ice cream. And I was like, yeah, we should do a drunk cast of ice cream. So what we need to decide now is what you're going to do during that. Because you speak on the podcast of being a big fan of wine.
Oh,
so I was thinking
wine.
Maybe we get you some really nice wines
just get
to taste.
Yeah.
So you do the drunk cast. Because I do the drunk cast maybe a couple of times a year. And we just – the drunk casts are normally 4 or 5 hours of me and two of my mates getting drunk. We've done some wines where we had Ramesh on and Brett Goldstein on. Ramesh on that one drunk a full bottle of Kraken in the first about 90 minutes. And about 3 hours in, he was like, good luck editing this. And I revealed that we don't edit them.
Amazing.
And he spent at least half hour just
panicking,
furious I'd ruined his career. He was like, this is my career done. So I guess the plan will be me and James will have a challenge of how many tubs of Ben and Jerry's we can eat. And how that affects us, how jittery we become.
Yeah.
And you'll just have some nice
I'll drink
wines
some wine
to get through.
I'll commentate on how the ice cream eatings go.
It's perfect, right?
Yeah.
Because my plan as well, I'd thought about it a lot, was I was going to also, because I think that at some point, the biggest episode of Off Menu is going to be when you guys give
your menus. Yeah.
So the way I was like, I'm not going to ask anything like that because that's unfair. But the way I was thinking, I might get James to do his menu, but all of them are starters. No, all of them are desserts.
You
to do all starters.
You're a starter, mate.
So you've got to choose your starter, your main starter, your side starter, and your dessert starter. And he's got to choose his starter dessert, his main dessert, his side dessert, and his dessert. Which is really confusing sentence. But I think I can instantly think of my dessert one and my starter one. So again,
I think there's something there.
So yeah, we'll put that together. It'll be in a few months because all of us are very busy. But yeah, I'm very excited about that. The mess that can be. I'm thinking, because I've been to visit the UK Ben and Jerry's headquarters.
Yeah.
And it's a little farm. So I'm thinking I might hit them up and say, can we come and do it there?
Right.
And then we'll just...
And I'll
we'll
just
figure it out.
Bring loads of wine with me.
Yeah, you'll bring loads of wine with you. Anyway, I don't know how we got onto that. We've gone completely off track. Oh, no, that's what I was going to ask, because you work with James.
Yeah.
And you're about to do your special. Is it at the Soho?
No, Leicester Square Theatre.
Specials have changed massively over the years. Like, we're out of the era of the DVD special.
Yes.
We're out of the era of the Louis C.K. kind of do it on your own special. Yeah. And ask people if you can masturbate while you're doing it special. and we're kind of out of the era of it goes on Netflix and it's a hit special, because there's so much on Netflix
now.
So it's such a very, we're at a really weird point where the accessibility is like it's never been before.
Yeah.
But almost the options are almost too confusing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Netflix is basically just, it's like when you could just put your own special on your website. Yeah. That's what Netflix is. Netflix is basically the internet.
There's so many on there now. And one of the things I was going to ask about, and I hate to do this because me and Brett discussed it, but how tough is it to have someone who's a close friend who smashed it so hard with his three Netflix specials?
Four, sorry.
It's the compensation.
Yeah.
And they're amazing, aren't they? And again, I'm loath to say nice things about James, particularly when he's not here.
Yeah.
But this stunning, and particularly for UK, it's kind of a big deal, particularly at that point, to get a Netflix special.
Yeah.
And this dude came out and got four Netflix specials at once. And I've recommended to people, you need to, if you can watch them all in one night, that's ideal.
Yeah.
If you can watch them all in one week, then that's good enough. But they're amazing.
I mean,
right?
I was there for, I mean, I get tweets regularly going, were you in the audience for all of those specials? And I was.
They're amazing, aren't they?
You can hear
me
and Nish squeaking through the whole thing.
No,
it's great. Like, I have zero professional jealousy, especially when it comes to James. I mean, I'm not saying I have zero professional jealousy. I get it all the time, but I've learned to manage it and recognize it for how insane it is.
Yeah, completely.
But never for James, because I know him and I know how hard he works.
He's wonderful, yeah.
He works so hard
yeah.
and is such a singular talent that, you kind of got to go, just give it up for that guy, right?
Yeah.
He's so good.
Completely. So what's the plan with yours? You're filming two. Again, we'd kind of, we'd rush this podcast in because I was like, it'd be good to promote your special.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty sure by the time it comes out, both are going to be sold out. So
yeah, I think it'll be, you know, tickets pop
though,
up
right?
now again. But at least, you know, we're talking about how it exists.
Yeah.
So when it does come out, then people will, those will go watch it.
So how kind of nervous / exciting is it? Because you're doing two in one day.
It's the same show twice in one day.
Yeah.
Which will be great, because I'm not that nervous about doing it yet, because a large majority of it is the show that I'm touring at the moment.
Yeah.
So I'm match fit with
that. I
know it back to front, and I'll be really loose with it. And then other stuff
is... It becomes a relief then.
Yeah.
I remember I filmed my Edinburgh Fringe show the one year I did the Fringe, and we hadn't planned to. I just got halfway through a 19-date run, and it occurred to me, oh, this is never going to be as good as it is now.
Yeah.
I need to get this recorded.
Yeah.
Because if I now plan a special in 2 months... It's not going to be as good. I'm doing this every night, and it's fucking as good as it'll ever be. So
the worst is if you're trying to remember
that you're
it. Yeah,
into this run.
Yeah,
and you can then go right now. I'm adding some parts, but
and the parts that I'm adding are older bits that I've done a lot anyway. So
and
are fun to play around with.
Yeah,
so. No, it should be good. I'm just going to do 90 minutes straight through per show.
Perfect.
No interval. Just crack through it.
It's a great venue as well,
it's
isn't
my
it? It's such a nice place to...
venue of that size, the Leicester Square Theatre.
It feels weirdly relaxing. I've done the podcast in there a few times, and when I do the podcast live, I generally don't have a guest. The audience just come up and we have chats.
Oh, cool.
And that should be bags of pressure, because you've got 2 hours to fill and you've got nothing planned. But it's such a relaxing place. The atmosphere of it, the crowds are always just,
I think there's something about the fact it's not... Like, there's just one level.
Yeah.
So it's not one of those, like, old Victorian, like, proscenium arch, like, three-tier things, you know. So they're not – which they're great venues because they're on top of you, but they're still very close and intimate. But it's just sort of nicely spread out. It's a great venue.
So what's the plan release-wise?
I'm not saying yet, because they're still, sorting everything
still
out. But it'll, you know, hopefully out. Available everywhere.
It'll be out there.
It'll be out there,
I love it. I watched Brian Callan. I've always – been a fan of him on podcasts, and I've never seen any of his stand-up, which again is the way with so many American comedians at the moment, because everyone's on podcasts or got podcasts, and you're like, I love that comedian. I've never seen any of his stand-up, but I love him. And I watched his because both of his were on Amazon Prime. And it was just, I love that there were, again, it was only a year or so ago, I'd say, if you weren't on Netflix. It was, for Americans, it was the the new HBO. If you weren't on, if you didn't have an HBO special, then you failed in some way.
Yeah.
And I'd say a year or two ago, if you've not got your Netflix special, it feels like it's not. But within that year, instantly, because you've got Amazon and Hulu and
move
and,
on, isn't it?
iTunes as well. We're making a big push in all those areas, and I love it. So let's rewind back to being at Durham. How was it to kind of start putting together comedy nights and putting together building a scene as such when you're starting off as well?
It's really exciting, and I would when people ask me what to do to start doing comedy, I always say if you're in somewhere like a university or you're in an educational institution, you may as well just do it there because no one's watching.
Yeah.
You can just, like you were saying
exactly
earlier,
you can
get good.
You can be shit.
Or
until...
you can just be terrible.
Yeah.
And try everything as well. Just try every... So I did sketch comedy, I did character comedy, I did stand-up, I did all of it. And, you know, worked out what I was best at and sort of pursued one angle. But it's, you can just be terrible.
It's great to get to try so many forms and mediums at the same time as well and see what
Because
what
the British industry, comedy-wise, I just don't I don't think there's much opportunity to do loads of things. I think people tend to box you in quite quickly. Because I always wanted to do, like, more acting stuff as well. And hopefully I will do at some point. The slight hurdle is that I'm terrible at auditions.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, once you're doing stand-up, people think of you as a stand-up.
Yeah.
So it's quite difficult
to maybe go and do
more acting stuff unless you're playing yourself.
It's great if you can – if someone will just put their faith in you.
Yeah,
if,
totally.
If you've got someone – and that's the beauty of the way TV is at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think risks are being taken – things like, I mean, Fleabag seems like the obvious example at the moment because of just how amazing it's been and what a phenomenon it's been. But there is more where people are going, I've got faith in you. And I mean, Rushing Connolly and Aisling Bea have both got shows recently where it feels like a channel has put faith in them as a creator, as an artist.
Yeah.
And that's where I think it's exciting for the comedians and the comedy scene because they're the people who will know you as more than just, I've seen you be funny on stage or on Mock the Week. They'll know, he's capable. This is perfect for him. So,
totally,
again, it's timing on stuff like that as well, I guess. If something comes up
I think
that
you're
works.
Right. Yeah, because also I say that you get put in a box in Britain, but then kind of like being a stand-up as well, sometimes people go, you can do that, so you can definitely have a go at this. You go, no, I've not trained for any of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they do just assume you can do some other stuff as well.
I always love the Mitch Hedberg joke. Are always saying as soon as you get successful at comedy, they ask you to write scripts and they ask you to act. And it's like, it's weird. Like, you don't go to a restaurant and someone makes some really good food and you go, this is really tasty. Do you farm? What? No, I don't farm. I cook. I'm a chef. And then he was saying about in an audition, they're like, so what's your acting experience? And I can say this because Mitch is dead, so I'm not ruining his material killing a live show, his next special. There's a bit where he's done an audition. They're like, what's your acting experience? He's like, when I'm playing pool and I make a shot, I act like I meant it.
Yeah.
And again, that's his complete acting experience. It's like, that's perfect. But it is a weird one. There's that weird... It's a weird middle ground, isn't it? That there's an assumption that you can do everything else, but then... often the things that you want to do, you're going, no, not that. Oh, that's not for you.
I think with acting as well, sometimes you just don't credit audiences with intelligence as if they're going to start watching a drama or something and then I've got a part in it and then they go, that's the guy from Mock the Week. It's completely taken me out.
Yeah,
it's like, no, they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they know
what
they're watching.
They know it's written acted. They know it's not a documentary. But yes, that's a weird one. But it must have been good to get, as I said, to play in all those areas at university.
Yeah.
How was it then to kind of, I guess, take off the safety wheels and go into the big wide world as comedians?
My memory of it is that I think I've always just sort of blundered through life quite a lot. I worry about stuff way more now.
Yeah.
Like if I had my brain now, if that was in my head when I left university, I don't think I'd be a comedian because I just left and thought, I'll keep doing that. It'll probably be all right.
Be fine.
I'll get a job, you know, just vaguely. My parents live in London and stuff, so I just stayed with my mum for ages.
Yeah.
So very lucky, very privileged in every sense. And then just sort of blundered through and ended up doing it as a job.
Yeah.
I think I always had it in my mind that I wanted to do it as a job, but you know, there was no worry. There was no like, but what if this doesn't happen? It's like, ah, well, might do.
It feels like it must have been kind of around the time that comedy was having a second kind of a resurgence in the UK.
Yeah.
It seemed like there was more of a scene, and not just in London.
Yeah.
There was comedy scenes blowing up in Newcastle, in Manchester.
So
in
Newcastle's sort of where,
all over the place.
Yeah, so because I was at uni in Durham, when I started doing stand-up at uni, like if I wanted to go and do gigs outside of the university sort of bubble, just, go up to Newcastle.
Because Dave Johns had his stuff up there, and there'd be loads of different
loads of clubs, loads of me and Nish both really sort of did quite a lot of formative gigs at a pub called the Dog and Parrot.
Yes,
there was a gig called Long Live Comedy at the Dog and Parrot.
My mate, I used to own that pub.
Oh, really?
Pub. We at one point when we had a gig cancelled in Newcastle last minute, we did a big tweet and big all over social media saying, "Look, the promoter has pulled the gig; it's out of our hands, but we've got hotels booked." So, do you want to all just meet in the Dog and Parrot and we'll just have a drink? And we had hundreds of our fans turn up and we all just had a drink.
Great.
And my mate Sam, who ran it, would hook a few of them up, but still he made some good money as well on the night. And we had
brilliant.
A lock-in and it was, it was
great.
I know that.
I got fond memories of the Dog and Parrot.
The little upstairs room.
That's where the gig was.
I went there on my spoken word tour as well, and it was, at that point, every other venue on the tour was 400 or 500 plus, and some up to 1,000, and then the Dog and Parrot was like 50, maybe 60.
Yeah, it's a really small room.
Yeah,
So I got really fond memories of Newcastle as a place to gig.
Yeah, that's great. So when did it kind of, or when did you feel that you didn't have to be thinking about, I can get another job, I can get this and that, like this is a career, I can make something of this?
Oh, I don't know if I
have you felt it yet?
No, I was going to say I don't. Probably, if it has happened, maybe the last 6 months.
And when do you think you'll feel that you can...
I mean, obviously, I constantly now live in fear that everything's going to be pulled out from under me.
Yeah.
But no, I think... I don't think that realisation ever really happens.
Yeah.
Like, there's not one moment that I can pinpoint where it's like, okay, I'm doing it. I guess I've made it. I guess this is my career now.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a career.
Yeah.
Because you just do so many different things, and it's just so... You're doing it for nothing for so long. I think I come to little realizations along the way where I think, like any self-employed person, you get to the point where you're like, okay, this offer's come in, but I'm not doing that.
You just go,
it's not worth anyone's while for me to travel there, travel back for that money. And then I think it's those sorts of realizations that you come to along the way.
That's the ideal position to be in, right? Particularly as a comedian where you're a jobbing comedian, there's a long time where you have to just take every gig because you never...
Yeah.
Or you need the stage time for one, and you never know what that gig will be.
Yeah.
The ideal part for any comedian, I think, is to be able to pick the ones that you can enjoy and not have to do the Friday night one that there's going to be loads of hen parties and drunk people who aren't... You're not really going to learn much there.
No.
Other than survival.
Yeah.
Which you hope isn't a tool you have to call upon too often if you're doing your own shows.
It's survival, and then just sometimes I'll do a gig just because I've not done that sort of gig before and I'd like to add it to the list of things that I've done. But I think that's as close as I've come to a realisation, is being able to go like, no, that's not for me this one.
Yeah, I'll pass.
I still feel guilty every time that happens.
Yeah.
Like, I still feel like, why am I turning stuff
who's
down?
Who's a big shot
who's
now?
This guy? Hello.
We touched upon a Mock the Week. How is that to have been? Because I'd imagine that's the first place I became properly aware of you and hearing your style and approach. How is that kind of thing to be part of? Because I think there's some really good panel shows and stuff on TV these days. I speak all the time about your Taskmasters and now I've forgotten the name of James and Josh's one. Hypothetical.
Yeah.
But it's a weird one because the thing that always comes to mind for me is I really like a Sean Locke stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him once or twice. I've got his DVDs. But there's nowhere I like him more than on 8 out of 10 cats. It's that weird thing of he's great as a stand-up, but in that, he seems to have just found this place that his tone, his style, his approach is just perfect.
Yeah.
How do you find a balance on things I like that? Because you really suit Mock the Week really well.
Well,
it seems like
it.
A really good spot for you, a really good... sometimes... when comedians are on some of these shows, obviously you're a regular, so it's going to be more relaxed. But sometimes it feels that they're a little bit uncomfortable and it's not really are what they do. It's not their style. Yeah, yeah. And you seem like someone that's completely home there, and you get to just enjoy it, right?
Yeah, it's a weird one because I never thought I'd get to do that show at all, because I grew up with Mock of the Week, really, and it's a completely different show now to what it to what it used to be.
It really is.
So it was so like it was great, but it was like Frankie and Russell just like drilling stuff. Like they'd just be like bam, 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 and it was looked like such an intense recording by all accounts was.
Yeah.
But now
I forget that Frankie was that's one of the places he made his name.
Oh man,
so harsh on, and it's a beautiful thing because he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and one of the most softly spoken.
I've never met him.
I had him on the podcast. He was just so calm, and I've heard him on a few other podcasts, and I love his. You expect him to be Mr. Offensive, and he's got a philosophy behind all of it. He's got this outlook.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet again, you kind of I'd forgotten that before you knew a wider thing of him. He was on there just saying the most outrageous shit. That's like, well, that's going to be in the papers tomorrow, obviously. Yeah.
It's amazing. It's it is that. It's like with metal bands as well. The people who make the most horrible noise.
Yeah, yeah.
Within what they do, and then you meet them, and they're just the most gentle, nice people.
I'm really nice to meet you, man. Soft spoken.
So that I grew up watching that, but I never thought it was my sort of thing. And it's such a big thing to do, especially for someone of my age. And when I got the call to be on it, it's terrifying. Yeah. But now it's a completely different show.
I was going to say, has it been to be part of kind of the transition of it or the evolution of it? Because again, it didn't occur to me until I was having a similar discussion about how it's changed. I must have got the pun, but I hadn't thought of the fact that Mock the Week is mock. It could be you're mocking the week,
and
in the early days it felt like that. He is someone that Frankie has got all the weapons in the world, and he is going to attack this person, and then Russell's going to go at this person. It was like, and now it's not any of that. It's mocking everything. It's not gone PC. It's not any of that silliness. It's just genuine, interesting comedic discussion of the news, and it feels like it's not just trying to get your punchline in.
No, definitely
it's
not.
It's more here's what's going on, and isn't this ridiculous, and making jokes, and it's not, oh, that's a good news story, I've got the punchline. Camera on Frankie, camera on whomever else.
So I think what's good about it is it's now there's a lot more building in the records now. So I think it's always been a very long record. I think it's like can be like 2.5-3 hours sometimes. And I can't imagine what that was like when they were just like hammering punchline time, because they would have been doing that for 3 hours and the audience would have been knackered. There's a lot more. It feels collaborative, and we build that's stuff and there's running jokes and things like that. And it's a lot more banter. And it's a pleasure
that was,
to be part of.
That was one of the shows that for a period had a bit of a negative reputation.
Oh, it had
for people being a guest on there, feeling that everyone is just trying to outshine you or shout over you, and it wasn't known as a very welcoming place. And again, I guarantee, or I would imagine, that wasn't through anyone's intention or planning.
Not at all.
If you're the guys on it and you feel you've got to deliver every week, it's going to be more, they've got the pressure on them and they're trying to deliver, and they're not thinking about, well, can this person who's here for one episode, let's give them some space. You're going to be thinking, it's my duty to come with 12 lines.
That's the rep it's got. But you're right. That's just because that's the sort of show it was, and they were doing their job. But now I think it's still sort of weirdly got that rep that's hung around from that. But so the new comics are always a little bit tense about it and about getting a word in edgewise, and you just think you'd be all right with we'll let you do your thing. Dara's amazing at throwing to people.
Yeah.
If you think someone's not said enough.
Again, this is completely just a James Acaster appreciation thing. When I was watching one the other week and he was on as one of his early appearances, and just he had the perfect technique of just talking slowly, unimpactfully, and weirdly. And it just left everyone. It was a rare bit of editing where they just left a moment of everyone kind of going, oh, all right. He just said that. I don't really know what's going on. It was the perfect way of, rather than trying to be, here's my quick line, bang.
Yeah.
Everyone laughed. Because again, also the reason those shows have that kind of rep is the crowd are used to the regular comedian.
Yeah.
So they're going to be primed to laugh at their stuff more, and not through any manipulation. That's just the way
it is. So the first episode you do, they always say it'll take you a while, and quite often the first episode you do, you get to do the stand-up round in the middle. And the advice I got was they might not go for everything you say until you do the stand-up. Yeah. When you get to prove yourself and you say, this is what I do, this is my voice, there's no one else talking, this is just what I do. And then they're keyed into it, and then for the rest of the episode, it'll be fine.
It's mad, isn't it? It's mad how all that works, because it's not contrived or controlled at all. It's just looking at the way a human nature is in such an unusual situation. Yeah. It's such a weird situation that there's a load of people watching a small selection of people kind of subconsciously battle for their approval.
Yeah, and it is subconscious. Audiences don't know what they're doing a lot of the time. No. It's not what audiences would say if you go and do the stand-up round and then they start laughing at your other stuff more, they'd be like, oh, your stuff in the second half was way funnier than the stuff in the first half. It's like, no, I could have swapped them around. You would have given them the exact same reaction.
And I love that. I always remember seeing Stuart Lee talk about, I think Stuart Lee and I've seen Anthony Jeselnik touch on it as well, just saying to an audience in their acerbic characters, kind of saying, that last bit was incredibly funny. I've been to a lot more gigs than you. Yeah. I know comedy. I know that was funny. You've not appreciated it, but that's kind of on you.
Yeah.
That's your fault. That's your ignorance to how comedy works, how structures work. And it's a similar thing there. You can't sit and go, no, I know the first half was as funny. Yeah, yeah, it's just subconsciously.
You're used
not,
to me now.
Yeah, yeah.
You're used to me now.
I'm now familiar and you feel relaxed. And again, that's the beautiful thing of comedy, when it's a crowd who have come for a comedian rather than a crowd that have come for a night out.
Yeah.
Is they come out. It's a thing I have a bit of advice I got on castings.
Yeah.
So this might help you if you're bad at them. Go if you
on,
feel.
Yeah.
Was someone just pointed out that their day is made easier.
Yes.
If you get the job.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's what they want. So they're on your side. You kind of go into it first thinking, oh, I'm up against everyone. This is horrible.
It's like,
no, they really, if you go in and do it, and they go, yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
That's that done.
Yeah, of course.
On to the next one. It's a positive thing. And similarly with crowds who've come to see a comedian. They've got a babysitter. They've done this, they've done that.
They really want to laugh.
Yeah. They really want to laugh. So as long as you go out there and do it and are aware of that, but if it's people on a night out, then they're more, well, coming in.
Yeah,
make me laugh.
You're interrupting our night out. We would have been on this night out anyway.
Come on.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre one. But yes, so do you have to find a balance between pushing for more panelist type stuff and focusing on stand-up, which is the one that you're in complete control of?
Yeah, totally. I think doing things like Mock the Week and any TV shows is nice when it comes along, but the main aim is it's good to get more people in to come and see you live. Like, that's the that's what it's for. I think it's probably quite easy to get lost in getting obsessed with doing as many TV shows as possible. But that's not the aim.
It's such a mad cyclical world, isn't it? Because in the music industry, I was kind of doing music in the period where you'd do a tour to promote your album, and then I was also in the period where it kind of transitioned that the album was to promote your tour,
because
that's where you started to make the money. And the comedy scene is weirdly cyclical. I like that, because for a long time it felt like the fringe was to get the attention of TV and radio execs to get a show so that you can get on TV. And then that'll make more people come to your show.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you were doing the show. It's such a weird thing that you're doing the show to get on TV, then you're doing TV to get on the show.
And then you get more people at the fringe the year after.
Yeah, and it's like, to get on TV, it's like, this is such a weird...
Yeah.
Which one's the actual fucking aim?
Yeah,
they're all trying to feed each other.
All feeds each other, it's all lumped together. But I think my aim was always, as a stand-up, to be able to do good-sized rooms on tour.
Yeah.
And do, like, theatres on tour, which is just, you know, happening over the last couple of years, which is great.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You know, and any TV I do now is exciting if it's something I enjoy. Again, there's, you know, things come in and you go, I don't think I'd be good on this because I won't enjoy it. If I know I'm not going to enjoy it, there's no point me doing it for any of us involved.
Completely.
Because I'm not going to throw myself into it.
I love shit like that. It's finding the right thing for you and realising the right thing for you is what will get you attention and praise.
Yeah.
I always remember in the music industry as well, the goal was to get daytime play on Radio 1.
Yeah.
Radio 1 airtime in the day. And it took me an hour or two to realise if I get my song in a good slot on Zane Lowe's evening show, there's less listeners than daytime, but they're the right crowd.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I remember the first time at our show, or it was playlisted, so it had to be on every daytime show. And one time it was in between, I think, Girls Aloud and some random one-off pop dance thing. And it's like, we've probably ruined someone's afternoon. Yeah. They were really enjoying everything. And then some preachy, ranty guys come that's not going to help much.
Yeah,
it's better to be in, to get that maybe smaller exposure in the right place and bigger exposure in the wrong place.
Yeah. I think, because I've done shows in the past that weren't necessarily my sort of thing or presented to the audience that would enjoy what I do anyway.
Yeah.
And you just think, I've watched it back and gone, you don't look that's like you want to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not going to go, oh, this guy's great because... You know, no one's enjoying that.
No.
So it's just
a terrible
exchange. I think you've got to be a bit selective.
Yeah.
As to what you actually enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you felt with the kind of still happening influence and power of the podcasting world? Because it does feel that that's now a new platform.
Yeah.
If you've got a podcast that's going well and Off Menu is going very well, it seems to have blown up really quickly.
We were surprised.
It's fantastic. It's getting a lot of love. It's getting a lot of attention. And that can start to influence. Again, I think America's a good example there again because podcasting was big over there before it kind of broke over here. And there's comedians over there. You look at your Joe Rogans and Mark Maron's even and people like that. They have doubled, tripled, quadrupled the size of crowds that they're playing to. And it's largely because of their podcasts that have let people get to know them a bit, I guess, and then they go, oh, I'd like to hear. And it's weird because you're not doing, like, on Off Menu, you're not doing any of your stand-up. It's not one of them shows where you can segue into a bit.
Yeah.
You're talking about food. It's completely different from... But
although both me and James have a lot of routines about food, to be fair. Like, I did a show in maybe 3 years ago that was... they had a 40-minute routine about cauliflower pizza in it.
Brilliant.
And James has had a food routine in every show. I've done halloumi material. So I think we've definitely got a background in that. I reckon I could get some stand-up material out of the off-menu discussions for sure.
But it must be good to have something that you can do again that, I mean, you clearly enjoy.
Yeah.
Clearly have real fun doing. But it is good for promoting everything. It's good platform. And there seems to be no negative. It seems to benefit in every way. And it's your own.
It doesn't feel like, but it's like you said, we enjoy it. So, and it at no point feels like we're going to go and do this for, it's not like doing press.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like you're doing promotion.
Completely.
Like coming in to speak to you, going on other podcasts and stuff. It's just fun, isn't it?
It tends to be good fun. It's such a good little world that's built that, again, it's exciting because it's out of the control of the controllers as such.
Yeah,
I always think if I ever did return to music, it'd be a different ball game
because
the previous press runs that you have to do that are laborious and not, it's like, I can just hit up all my mates who are podcasters now.
Totally.
If I was to do another album, I could go on some huge places that's just my friends that I would enjoy.
Yeah.
And it not be, you've got to do this in the morning, then you've got to go and do this one, and it's all all shit. It's mad how
I think,
the landscape's
changed. A couple of guests we've had on have said that, you know, they do a good episode of Off Menu, and then suddenly they'd see a rise in ticket sales, like more than if they did some like regional press or stuff like that. And it's great,
isn't it?
And it's fun, and like I did a podcast years ago, back when, so it's probably post Gervais, but pretty quickly after Gervais, like 2009, I would say. So I did a podcast with a guy called Ian Boldsworth,
yes.
For years, we did the Ray Peacock podcast and then Peacock and Gamble podcast, and then stopped doing it. And so I've come back to it a few years later, and it's completely changed. Like everyone's got one, but also it's a massive market.
Yeah,
like also you can make some money, which is we never thought that would happen.
That's the mind blowing part of it. That I probably earn as much off my podcast because it's every week.
Yeah.
As I would have from doing one tour a year or a couple of tours and things like that. And it's like, that's ideal because that means, number one, again, I just get to have cool conversations with people I like. And they're arranged as we were, just send you a message, all right, I'm about Thursday.
Send
there's
a text
no
to a mate and
big
it's fine,
drama
yeah.
over it. How much do you enjoy, I mean directly on the podcast, but I guess in life as well, how much do you enjoy James just getting really angry?
Oh, I love it.
Because the obviously... the Joel episode.
Yes.
But the one that got me more was, as I said, the Victoria...
Yeah, that
Victoria
was great.
Mitchell one just recently. Man, it was so good. just seeing him getting angrier and angrier at her food choices.
Because it built. The good thing about that was with Joel.
And her being so nice and lovely, because I'd seen her on the main thing I'd seen her on was her game show, where she's quite strict and stern. So I didn't know her as a person. And she was absolutely lovely and kind of almost apologetic for James being so furious at her food choices. And that must be a lot of fun, right? Because I know as well, knowing James, you know, you're performing.
Yeah.
He's angry about
that. Oh, no,
that.
He was genuinely angry.
He's genuinely annoyed.
With Joel, so Joel Dommett had a terrible menu as well.
Yes.
But we both know Joel really well. Yeah. So we immediately laid into him.
I thoroughly enjoyed that because, again, I'm a bit of a fitness guy these days.
Yeah. Are you a CrossFit guy as well?
Yeah, I'm a CrossFit guy. Right. I'm into my protein shakes and stuff like that.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have it on your dream menu.
I didn't have it on my dream menu, as you saw. I had pizza and ice cream mainly. I wanted to pick him up because it's a common myth that sweet potato and potato actually, because the myth originally was that sweet potato is a lot healthier.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the new kind of the woke community were like, no, they're actually exactly the same measurements, but they have got the same on paper. But for example, there's good carbs and there's bad carbs, and there's good sugars and there's bad sugars. And a sweet potato, although it may have the same sugars, it's higher in the good sugars than the bad sugars. So if you can let Joel know
that
it's slightly off. I know it because I went down that same route as well and then got kind of educated by someone else. That it's not quite as simple as that.
Have you had Joel? Have you had Joel on the podcast?
I haven't.
Well, why don't you have him on and do a sweet potato special?
I think I might have, right? This is a weird one. I think it was Joel years ago. Is while I was doing a music, I got asked to come in and audition as a presenter for a PlayStation channel that they were launching. And Carl Donnelly was there. Yeah. And that's the first time I met Carl, and he was great. And in my head, I think Joel was there. But I've not seen or met him since. I've seen him at things and we don't know each other. So I was like, do we know each other or not? And I always remember that I didn't get the thing because we had a little bit. I was dead proud of this. We had a little bit where they was like, pretend you're in, they'd pair you with a girl each time.
Okay.
And they'd say, pretend you're interviewing this current pop star. And they said, pretend you're interviewing Evie Brown. And I said, James Brown, Bobby Brown, Chris Brown, Evie Brown, have you ever domestically abused a partner? Because it's just a weird coincidence that all the Browns in the music industry, the surname Brown, sorry, this isn't any racial, that's not anything that's offensive there. And I thought that was a really good little, but it was for a kind of pop world type thing, which wouldn't have worked nicely.
I don't think you can have the opening list be about domestic abuse, can you?
I didn't get the gig. But yeah, the Joel Dorrit one was absolutely amazing because, again, it was similar to the Victoria Coromichra one because he was also completely unaware that was an outrageous choice of a menu. His whole menu was completely unacceptable, even as someone who's a fan of a lot of healthy stuff and things like that. Yeah. And he was just, it felt like he didn't come in to antagonise in any way.
He didn't. He never does. He's the loveliest man. So he didn't come in to antagonise. His face was a picture because he looked surprised that we were angry at him.
Yeah.
But that was easy because we'd know Joel. We always take the piss out of him. Yeah. We like get angry with him on a regular basis because he doesn't get angry. He's not an angry man at all.
And at the end of the day, he wins because his body is phenomenal.
He looks absolutely
so
amazing.
So you can get as angry as you like about his choices, and then all he has to do is whip his shirt off and go, see you later, guys. Yeah.
I saw him the other day.
You won this time, you swine.
I saw him the other day, and he just bid for a facial. And honestly, he just looked like a painting. I was like, you fucking kidding me? Look at you.
I love it. I love it.
But with Victoria, neither of us, like, I'd not met her before.
Right.
James had met her a couple of times. She'd been on Hypothetical and done another TV show with him, maybe. So they know each other, but not well enough for him to immediately come flying out the gate and go, what the fuck are you talking about?
That was the beauty of it.
So it meant just it built and built. And by the end, he had his head in his hands. And you can hear me. Like, obviously, I don't like her menu at all.
Yeah.
Like, if it's a dream menu, it's very bland for a dream menu. But you can hear me going, oh, I think that sounds lovely, Victoria.
Yeah,
rice pudding.
You do very much play good cop, bad genie. In that podcast, but yeah, it was the beauty there was the politeness that it built and built, and then when he had to reread the menu, the fact that she'd gone for tap water at the start, which at the start I was the same. I was like, it's no big deal. I go for tap water a lot, but when you've then chosen a Plowman's and rice pudding, then it's like the tap water was the breaking point. It's like, how dare you choose?
It is, honestly, now you run through with tap water as well. It's It's like we asked her to pick her last meal on death row, and she picked what was on the prison menu anyway.
Yeah. I'll just take whatever you've got.
Whatever you've got. Plowman's lovely, yeah.
I love it. So what's ahead? I'll start to wrap things up. Are you recording your special?
Yeah.
Is the tour continuing after that? Is it a new tour?
No, it's the same.
It's a weird one. I never know where the fringe... The fringe seems to exist outside of the rest of the comedy scene. It seems to be... The fringe is its own thing, and then there's tours around it, there's tours within it, there's tours climbing over it.
I'm doing it a bit weirdly this time. So normally what I do is do the fringe in August, then tour autumn, and then write a new show for the fringe in building up to August. But I'm taking my first year off the fringe.
Are you delighted?
I'm very, very excited because the last year off I had was 2010.
Yeah.
And before that, I did 2004 to 2010, then 2011 to 2018.
It's a weird one for comedians, the fringe, isn't it? Because it is this poison chalice of sorts. Because it annoys people a bit. Brett Goldstein's an example, because I adore the fringe, but I've only done it once, and I was already established. So I had a really good time. I had 19 sold-out shows. It went really well. Everyone said nice things about it. And I was like, this fringe lark is delightful, isn't it? But for everyone, it is... the home of, you know, the highest highs and the lowest lows in the comedy world. If it goes well, my God, it feels euphoric. But if it goes bad, it's the most lonely place in the world because you're so far away from everything and you're throwing money at it. And
both will happen.
Yeah.
Like, you're there for a month, so you definitely will have the highest highs and the lowest lows.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky month, but I don't mind it as much as other people do.
Yeah.
But I just decided to try and squeeze every audience member out of this tour as possible this time.
Perfect.
So I toured it in the spring. I'm filming the special because the special came around relatively recently. We'd already booked in an extension for the tour.
Cool.
So I'm doing the special. Then I'm doing more tour September to December.
Great.
And then I'd imagine writing a new one for 2020. 2020.
That's scary, isn't it? That's on its way.
But exciting as well, because I love getting to the point where you're like, oh, I did get a show seemingly out of nothing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I love that. And it must be good, to get to just push that through without having the impending shadow of the fringe hanging over, and then know that you can just focus on it and do it really well and get the special, get more shows, and then start to think about that. It must be nice. I think almost mentally it should be mandatory that you're only allowed... I like Glastonbury always has a year off every 4 years. Yeah, there should be a fallow year for all comedians.
For
they should look and go, no, you've done the last four. We can't take you this year.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
That would be good. A crop rotation system for the mind.
It works. It makes sense. Well, where can people keep up to date on your tour and on what's going to happen with the special and all that kind of thing?
All social media stuff, at Ed Gamble Comedy on Twitter and Instagram, and my website, edgamble.co.uk.
And the off-menu socials is decent, isn't it?
And that's our producer, the great Benito. So
he does good stuff there, and he puts out the content. And there's also, I assume it's a fan, but there's a fan that does out-of-context off-menu quotes, and they crack me up. I see them all the time.
Great.
They're just brilliant, just some random...
It's normally things I've forgotten have been said as well.
Completely.
Yeah.
That makes it seem like the most bizarre podcast in the world. But in context, I didn't bat an eyelid. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
for
having me, man.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's flown by.
Really fun.
Thank you. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Ed Gamble. You should all go and see his show on May 12th. You should all go and see the tour that comes after it. But also, you should all go to social media immediately if you haven't already and get very excited towards me, towards James Acaster, towards Ed Gamble, and, I mean, potentially towards Ben and Jerry's about the Ice Cream Drunk Cast that we're going to record. Because now that we've said it out loud on record, now we have to do it. It's one, like, you may or may not know, but there's so much stuff that podcasters and comedians and all sorts have all these plans privately that you then get busy. All of us have busy, weird, unusual schedules.
But yeah, now we've said it out loud, you guys can hold us to it, can berate us. If you're tagging Ben and Jerry's, tag Ben and Jerry's UK, because they're going to have to put up with a lot of illness, probably, from me and James, from eating ourselves into a sugar coma. But yeah, thank you for tuning in. I said I'd mention Pod Bible. Pod Bible is... Go on the socials and have a look. There's a blog at podbiblemag.com and the magazine itself. And I'm really proud to be involved in it. It's a really good podcast platform and magazine for shouting about new stuff, reminding you of old stuff, and just generally, yeah, helping you all out there. My club night is back, end of the month, May 25th. We've just confirmed Doc Brown as our guest DJ, previous guest of the podcast, and previous guest down at the book club. He did an amazing set, and we've been dying to have him back. So yeah, that's May 25th. I'd like to see you all there. That's at the book club. It's We Are Lizards. I will be donning a rubber lizard mask and spinning some tunes and sweating and getting drunk. Yeah. Other than that, I will see you all next week. I've got two next week. In fact, next week's main episode is one that I've been hyping for a while. It's the Tim Clare episode. It's one of my favourite conversations I've had, and Tim and I know he may not be the biggest name ever, but honestly, you're really going to enjoy it. I really urge you to listen to that one, because it's, yeah, it gets weirdly personal. It gets wonderfully informative, inspirational, and educational. And yeah, I think you'll like it. And then there's going to be a bonus one next Sunday, but I'm not going to tell you about that. I might tell you next week about it, but I won't tell you about it now. Yeah. All right. I will see you all next week. Have fun. Be good to yourselves and each other. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.